After 2 whole years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile, and behold, there came up of the Nile 7 cows, attractive and plump, and they fed in the reed grass. And behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly thin cows ate up the 7 attractive plump cows. And Pharaoh woke, and he fell asleep and dreamed a second time. And behold, 7 ears of grain, plump and good, were growing on one stalk. And behold, after them sprouted 7 ears, thin and blighted by the east wind. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump full ears. And Pharaoh woke, and behold, it was a dream. So in the morning his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Starting to feel like 13 years, isn't it? Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, "I remember my offenses today. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, we dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream, and he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged." Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." And Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It's not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Behold, in my dream, I was standing on the banks of the Nile." And just for time's sake, we know the dream, okay? We're going to skip down to verse 37. I'm sorry, to verse 25. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one. The 7 lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the 7 empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of famine that will follow, for it will be very severe. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dreams mean that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers of the land to take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food for these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. The food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine." This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." The Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him ride in his second chariot, and they called out before him, "Bow the knee." Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zephaniah-Paneah, and gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, went through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly, and he gathered up all the food of these 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt, and put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields abounded. And Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. Before the year of famine came, 2 sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardships and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph has said. There was famine in all the lands, but in the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Pharaoh, what he says to you, do. So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe all over the earth. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. Why don't we stand and pray, and then I'll let you sit down again. Our Father, what a wonderful record of your faithfulness and the faithfulness of your servant. Thank you for blessing us with it and for a reminder that you are the God over all. And I pray, Lord, that as we take a moment to look at a theme or two from this, that you would be blessed to visit us by your Spirit. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Anybody familiar with Jim Gordon's book, One Word That Will Change Your Life? It's not typically a book that circulates in our circles. It's similar to the idea that Jim Collins pointed out in his very influential book, Good to Great. It's an idea about being effective by simplifying. And in both books, the idea is being effective by simplifying. Collins calls it the hedgehog concept, which is based on an old Greek proverb that the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing well, and that it's better to be more like a hedgehog in your business, and then Jim Gordon would extend that to your life, to know one thing really well than to be moderately good or mediocre at a number of things. One of the case studies that Collins uses in his book, Good to Great, is Wells Fargo as an example of a bank that began to look at its place in this world and decided there's no way we can compete globally, so our mission is going to be the best U.S. bank in the Western Quadrant of the United States. And in interviewing for this book, Collins talked to several employees, and one of them said about the CEO of Wells Fargo at the time, if he were an Olympic diver, he wouldn't do the 2-flip, 5-twisty dive. He would do the swan dive better than anybody had ever done it. And he would practice it over and over and over and over again. And the hedgehog concept is one of the more endearing concepts out of Collins' books, although they all get a lot of publicity. So what in the world does this have to do with Genesis 39 to 41? Joseph and us. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. You know, sometimes throughout this series about living faithful in a fallen world, I and maybe you, I don't know, I get daunted. I get a little bit doubtful. And sometimes, quite honestly, even a little bit depressed. I mean, I think we're all in agreement, this world's pretty much a mess. You don't have to look too much further than just this morning's news, let alone a week's worth of tragedy. There's so much that needs to change that could be done. And the problems are so complex and large. And that's just my house. Thank you for laughing. I was hoping that would be a moment of levity. And so, what am, or even what can I do? And what can we at MPC do? What are we supposed to do in the face of incredibly complex long-term problems? How can I possibly have the answers or resources to address the vast number of problems, sin situations, systemic breakdowns? 2 years ago, Tara and I were in Brazil, and we spent about 2 hours with Ana Claudia. I remember because it was arduous, and Tara was having an allergic reaction to their cats, and we were sharing the gospel with Ana. She had 2 children by 2 different men. She was pregnant by a third. And as we sat there sharing life with her, I just had an overwhelming sense of despair. Not only because I didn't think it was going well, I just realized that she very well may profess Christ by the time we're done. But that'll do very little to alleviate her situation. Now, please understand what I'm saying. Okay? She's trapped in repeated cycles of looking for love in all the wrong places, looking for love in too many faces, looking for rest, for security, for comfort. And I'm here for 2 hours. And then I remembered that refrain at the end of Revelation 18 where the people in heaven are rejoicing that Babylon has fallen. And I used to wonder why they were rejoicing at billions of people dying. And I realized at that moment, that's not what they're rejoicing at. They're rejoicing that sin and all of its manifestations, all its systemic outworkings, all of the ways in which it entangles and ensnares and enslaves is done once and for all. And never again will people like Ana Claudia be wandering around looking for someone to take care of her. Several months ago, I was introduced to an essay by the Reverend Dr. Samuel Wells, who's now at King's College in London, and he previously served as the Dean of Chapel at Duke University, so a real dummy. The article is titled Rethinking Service. I would love to share it with you, and if you're interested, come see me. But he asks this question: what is the essential problem of human existence? He's going to assert in this article that how you answer that question will form the basis of your service and mission as a person, as an institution, and as a church. Remember, I told you there was a little word in Joseph's story. I'm going to get there, but it's going to be a few more minutes, okay? Wells argues that the culture's answer to the essential problem of human existence is mortality. Or in the words of Samuel Beckett, we give birth astride the grave. The light gleams an instant, the night once more. Hebrews tells us that Christ came to deliver all those who through fear of death were subjected to lifelong slavery. So death and mortality are a problem, and we see evidence all around us of people living in fear of their mortality. The youthfulness movement, the drive to extend life as long as possible, the multitude of trial and error solutions to overcoming limitations of body, mind, and spirit. Where is it all coming from? It's coming from a deep-seated fear that this life is all there is. So YOLO, you better make the most of it, right? Wells writes, everything in our culture, and especially our institutions of higher education, orients us toward solutions, toward answers, toward ways to fix the human body, the human mind, the world's economy, the inside of a laptop, the woes of Washington, the finances of Greece, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the poverty of Somalia. If you assume that the fundamental human problem is mortality, then you'll be upholding the Millennium Development Goals. You'll be providing artificial limbs for use by people in war zones who have been maimed by landmines. You'll be digging wells for people in locations where there is a dearth of fresh water. When the human problem is mortality, then this is what mission and service are. They are generous acts of reducing mortality, alleviating human limitation in ways that are not income generating, but are nonetheless life enhancing for both giver and receiver. You know, for us, it's natural just to say that death is the problem. I mean, it's in the Bible. The wages of sin is death. Death is unnatural. But why? Why? So it's natural for us, when we think about faithful living in a fallen world, to think in terms of solutions for, answers for, service for. And very often that's how we operate. I give for charity. I cooked for my family at Thanksgiving. I opened my home for this. And there's nothing wrong with for. But doing many things for others or even for God can leave us daunted, doubtful, and even a little depressed. Martha was really into for. And not only that, there can be a dark underbelly of a for mentality. See, I can do many things for you while remaining completely detached from you. But what if the central problem of humanity isn't mortality, Wells asks, but isolation? And what if we understood that the central heart of God is not the preposition for, but rather the preposition with? How might our approach to life, our approach to family, our approach to missions be changed if we took into our hearts what is so clearly in God's? Because what is death? We say they're no longer with us. What is eternal death? The horror of hell is not its fire. It's its separation and isolation from God and everyone else. And so this is worth thinking about. One last quote from Wells. We have stumbled upon the most important word in the Bible. The word that describes the heart of God and the nature of God's purpose and destiny for us, and that word is with. That is what God was in the very beginning. That is what God sought to instill in the creation of all things. That is what God was looking for in making the covenant with Israel. That is what God coming amongst us in Jesus was all about. That is what the sending of the Holy Spirit meant. That is what our destiny in the company of God will look like. It's all in that little word, with. God's whole life and action and purpose are shaped to be with us. Indeed, the closing refrain of the Bible. It's the dwelling place of God is with man. And so finally, we return to Joseph. And listen, we're not going to get out of chapter 39, but that's okay. Because one of the questions that we're asking is this: how do we live faithfully in a fallen world? And I want to suggest to you that if you want to end your dauntedness, if you want to end your despair, if you want to end your confusion about what in the world am I supposed to be doing here for the world, then you're asking the wrong question, because we don't have the answers for the world and all its complexity. We have the gospel, which of course changes everything, but God didn't send us here to be answer people. He sent us here to be with. So let's look again at chapter 39. I told you in the beginning of the reading that there were 20 out of the nearly 5,000 words in this portion of Joseph's story that would make the difference, and you can find them in 39:2, 39:3, 39:21, and 39:23. And those words are this: the Lord was with Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph, and he succeeded in all he did. And that is an astounding statement, but not an unusual one. in the Bible. God said to Moses, go, I will be with you. God said to Abraham, I will be with you. God is here saying to Joseph, I will be with you. We see in David's life the refrain that the Lord was with him and gave him success. We see Daniel, the Lord was with Daniel. And we see, as we almost read this morning, John 1, in the beginning the Word was with God and the Word was God. And then Jesus came to be with us. When he left, he said, don't worry, I'm going to send the Spirit of God to be with you. And one day, I'm going to bring you to be with me. The Lord was with Joseph. He was with him in his being sold to Potiphar. And he was with him in his master's house so that under Joseph's faithful eye and hand, all that Potiphar had succeeded. And note the phrase that Joseph's master Potiphar saw that the Lord, Yahweh, was with Joseph and entrusted him with everything. But then we see this. Potiphar's wife wanted to be with Joseph. And Joseph refused to be with Potiphar's wife because you see, men and women, there's a way of being with people that actually destroys the very community that you're trying to establish by being with people. Perhaps Potiphar's wife exists in isolation. Potiphar's a busy guy. Joseph is a handsome guy. Potiphar's away. You'll do. Sins of that nature are often not about the sins of that nature. As G.K. Chesterton said, the hand that knocks on the door of the brothel is seeking for God. But actually, many times what we're seeking with is to not be alone. And yet Joseph saw that this would not be a union that would produce the kind of intimacy and community and withedness that God intends. And God was with him. And he was not going to fracture his relationship with God to produce something that would not last. And so he says to the wife, how could I do such a thing? Your husband has entrusted everything to me, and how could I sin and be so wicked in the sight of God? And hell hath no fury, right? Like a woman scorned. And yet she pressed day after day after day after day. He's 18, 19, away from home. Nobody's going to know. He's at the height of his success when many of us are most vulnerable to temptation when things are going well. But he wouldn't do it. And then that fateful day, when no one else was in the house and he walked in and Potiphar's wife grabbed him by the cloak, it's not the outer garment, said, come to me. And he did what the Bible later will say we should all do. He fled immorality. Ray Stevens would say, naked as a jaybird. And he left. Now he's going to be framed for doing the right thing. And yet, we know the Lord was with him. Ever cross your mind that maybe imprisonment was the answer to Joseph's prayer about Potiphar's wife? I'm finally out of her prison. Why didn't Potiphar kill him? Maybe he knows. Maybe the servants knew. Maybe he just realized that this was too good a thing to kill and let go of, because we're told later in the text, where's this prison? It's on Potiphar's property. So now I get the benefit of Joseph without really having to pay him. He's in the prison. And then I want to point something out in chapter 40. The Lord is with Joseph. Joseph refused to be with Potiphar's wife in an illicit, destructive way. And I want you to look at verse 4 of chapter 40. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them. Now, it could very well be that this is just a small prison. Where else is he going to be? And yet, there's been such an emphasis in this chapter on the word with. I just don't think it's accidental. And they continued for some time in custody. And then I love the irony and the wonderful nature of verse 6. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. Does anybody else find that weird? They're in prison. On what morning in prison do you not wake up troubled? But I want you to notice something else. He observed that they were. Because in being with them on normal days, he knew what an abnormal day looked like. Verse 7, so he asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in custody, there it is again, why are your faces downcast today? I don't know how much emphasis to put on today, but it just strikes me that here is Joseph. I mean, good grief. Booted out of the family by his brothers, sold into slavery, put into Potiphar's house, things are going well, boof. Falsely accused by his wife, he gets thrown into prison, and yet he's concerned about the cupbearer and the baker. I'm sure that kind of concern happens in prison, but probably rarely. Of course, they tell him the dreams, and he interprets them. And Joseph asks the baker, the cupbearer, please don't forget about me when you get there, because I've done nothing wrong to be in this pit. Twice the word pit is used. But he's forgotten. And then this little word pops up again in chapter 41 when the cupbearer says, you know, Pharaoh, I was thinking about my offense. I didn't want to bring it up the past 2 years. Things have been nice. There was a Hebrew, do you see the word? With us in prison. And as Paul Harvey would say, you already know the rest of the story. Men and women, boys and girls, our world needs Jesus. Because to die without him is to die without him. And I want to empower you with this thought. You don't have to fix your neighbor. You don't even need to begin to know how to fix your neighbor to be with them. Isn't it true? We rarely remember the people that gave us good answers, but we remember the people that were with us when life was hardest. I do hospital visitation. It makes me uncomfortable because I don't know what to do for them. I don't know what to say to them. And the truth of the matter is, I just need to be with them and wait for God to do what he's going to do. It's tricky though, isn't it? Sometimes it's easier just to do four. Yeah. Keeps me unentangled. Keeps my life options open. But that's not the Jesus way. As we close, hold your applause. I wish I could say this better, but I can't, so I'll just read it. No one could be more tempted to retreat into doing four than God. God, above all, knows how exasperating, ungrateful, thoughtless, and self-destructive company we can be. Most of the time, we just want God to fix it and spare us the relationship. But that's not the God way. God could have done it all alone. But God chose not to. God chose to do it with us, even though it cost the cross. That's the amazing news of the word with. The cross is usually portrayed as the ultimate moment of four, the definitive thing only God could do that God did on our behalf. But let's think about the cross for a moment in the light of what we've seen about the word with. The cross is Jesus' ultimate demonstration of being with us, but in the cruelest irony of all time, it is the instant Jesus finds that neither we nor the Father are with him. Remember Jesus' agonizing words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Every aspect of not with, of being without, clusters together at the foot of the cross. Jesus experiences the reality of human sin because sin is fundamentally living without God. Jesus experiences the depth of suffering because suffering is more than anything, because suffering is more than anything the condition of being without comfort. Jesus experiences the horror of death because death is the word we give to being without all things, without breath, without connectedness, without consciousness, without a body. Jesus experiences the biggest alienation of all, the state of being without the Father and thus being not God, being for this moment without the with that is the essence of God. Jesus gives everything that he is for the cause of being with us, for the cause of embracing us within the essence of God's being. He has given so much, even despite our determination to be without him. And yet he has given beyond our imagination because for the sake of our being with the Father, he has, for this moment, lost his own being with the Father. And the Father has longed so much to be with us that he has, for that moment at Calvary, lost his being with the Son. Here's the astonishing good news. At the central moment in history, Jesus, the incarnate Son of God, had to choose between being with the Father or being with us. And he chose us. At the same time, the Father had to choose between letting the Son be with us or keeping the Son to himself. And he chose to let the Son be with us. That's the choice on which our eternal destiny depends. That's the epicenter of the Christian faith and our very definition of love. So men and women, be with your Father. Be with his Son. Be with his Spirit. And then go be faithful and change this world by being with people that have no one else to be with. Just like Jesus.